Hi, this is Mimi Sheraton, author of 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die, and you are listening to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Hi everybody, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm Hester, proud correspondent for the British Bomb Squad. Our regular host Kerry Diamond is travelling the country for the Cherry Bomb Cookbook Tour, so I'm taking this opportunity to sneak in and showcase one of the finest women from the UK food scene. There's such a rich collection of writers, chefs, makers, interesting women in the food world in the UK, and I can't wait to share this particular one with you. First of all, let's thank our sponsor. This season of Radio Cherry Bomb is presented by Le Cordon Bleu. Le Cordon Bleu, the legendary culinary school, has locations around the globe, from Paris to London to Ottawa. The schools have a wide array of programmes available, from nine-month classical culinary training programmes all the way to bachelor and master's degrees. Visit cordonbleu.edu for more. Before we get to the special guest, we have our new feature, the Cookbook Call-In, where we get an inside look at one of the recipes from the Cherry Bomb Cookbook. Of course, recipes from 100 badass women in the food world. And this week, Kerry talks to writer Sierra Tischgart about her mother's famous noodle kugel.
We're really excited that Sierra Tischgart from Grub Street gave us a great recipe for her mom's noodle kugel. So in the book, it's called Joan Tischgart's Noodle Kugel. We have to shout out to Joan. Sierra, tell us why you gave us this recipe.
So this is my favorite family recipe. It's also one of the only family recipes I really hold dear. And my mom has made it every year for Thanksgiving for as long as I can remember. And I have a crazy sweet tooth. I want everything to be sugary. And this is the perfect, like, sneaking something that's arguably dessert into the savory dinner portion. And it really actually, like, I think hits right in between the two because it's a noodle casserole, but it's quite sweet. And it has these golden raisins and cinnamon on top. It's just like comfort food at its best. It's a traditional Jewish dish, but each Jewish family makes very much their own version. It's not like I want anyone else's kugel. I only want my mom's.
Your mom only makes this for Thanksgiving? She doesn't make it for the Jewish holidays?
We're like the Jew-ish, like emphasis on ish kind of Jews. So she'll make it occasionally, but we really don't celebrate the other holidays as much as we celebrate Thanksgiving.
So I've never had kugel before, so I was really excited when we made this. I love macaroni and cheese, and like you, I have a wicked sweet tooth. And this is like if dessert and macaroni and cheese had a baby.
Yes, it's actually a perfect way to put it. Yeah, it's kind of bizarre, and I don't think that sounds appetizing to people when we say it like that, but it really is the kind of thing where, like, I'm sneaking a bite before it's done. I love having it for leftovers. Like, I'm eating it for as long as possible, and it's really good for any meal of the day.
It was painful for us to not keep snacking on it. So anybody who wants to make this, it's a great dish because you can find all these ingredients in a grocery store. You don't have to run and find any of these specialty ingredients.
Yes, definitely. It is very basic. There are only a few ingredients, but I say the one thing to make sure you have is the golden raisins. It really ties in the whole look of it. I can't imagine it with any other raisin. I'm not even sure if golden raisins have a different taste or not, but I just feel like it's very important to this and for the aesthetic purposes.
So Joan would not be happy if we used, like, purple raisins in this dish?
Nope, she would not. And the cinnamon is also really what makes it.
Why is cinnamon key?
To me, actually, even though cinnamon's not sweet, it really takes it into that, is this dinner, is this dessert territory? Like, I don't know, it has just like a very comforting, it makes it seem more like a bread pudding to me when I put the cinnamon on top.
Now, have you made it very often or do you just want your mom's?
I've made it once, but the nice thing about the recipe is that I think it's quite easy to execute. It is not like she has some magical touch. You know, it's the idea of being around a family and us all having it together. It's not the same without them there.
Well, since we are now authorities on Joan's noodle kugel. We do have a few tips. I think the first time we made it, we didn't push the raisins under the surface, so the raisins burned a little. So you do want to push the raisins down. I know that sounds crazy, but when you make it, you will know exactly what we mean. So that way you don't have these like weird burnt raisins on the top. The other thing, and you might have seen this when your mom like pulls it out of the oven, the top puffs up slightly, but then once you take it out, it deflates kind of radically. Did you ever notice that?
Yes. Yes, I have. That's interesting. Yeah.
So do not be scared.
She also has burnt raisins on top.
Oh, wait. Your mom's
never thought to push that.
Your mom's cool with the burnt raisins? Maybe we should just let them be.
I mean, I think the objective, you know, like the better thing is to not have them burn, but she always has them burnt.
Well, we want this to be authentic to the Joan Tishgard experience. So maybe don't push your raisins down then. So don't be afraid if it deflates, though, because it is going to deflate. Now, Sierra, I'm guessing that there are rarely leftovers in your house, given how much your family loves this dish. But is it something that's good the next day, or should you try to eat it all day one?
No, it is great even days later. And I often either put it in a toaster oven or just microwave it for a few seconds, and it heats up perfectly.
We ate a lot of Mom's Kugel cold.
Yeah, also good cold.
It's pretty good cold. It's one of those things that, like, any time of the day, you just want to go in with a knife and make like a little sliver and just eat it. It's so yummy. I have to thank you for introducing me to this dish. I'm embarrassed that I grew up in New York and never had this before.
I'm so glad. Yeah, it's really a nice hallmark of Jewish food. And I loved growing up eating it. I think it's also very indicative of how my mom perceived food, which was like really wanting to bring comfort and joy. We were not a fancy food household at all. So it brings me back to just like that simple pleasure.
So how did you get your mom to share this recipe with us?
Oh, she was thrilled. She was so happy to have it reach a wider audience and have recognition. So my sister was a little bit protective of it, I must say, in an older sister fashion.
So if you are cooking for Thanksgiving, you might want to try your hand at Joan Tishgard's noodle kugel. Is your mom making it for this Thanksgiving?
Yes. Oh, definitely. I missed last Thanksgiving because I was in Taiwan, so I'm even more excited now.
Aw.
And yes, I'd say also if you celebrate the Jewish high holidays, it's a great recipe for that as well.
Fantastic. Well, Sierra, can you give your mom a big thank you for us?
Yes. Thank you, Mom.
We're thrilled that she shared the recipe with us. And thank you, Sierra. Take care.
Thanks, Gary.
That noodle kugel sounds fascinating. I would love to see what it tasted like. I was lucky enough to take part in a CB supper club for the International Women's Supper Club, which was very nice to represent it over in the UK. It was fascinating seeing women cooking all over the world from the Cherry Bomb cookbook. We made Melissa Clark's incredible salmon and potato salad, along with the million ingredient autumn salad and the grapefruit cocktail, which went down a storm. Anyway, back to Olya. Olya Hercules was born in the south of Ukraine, and she moved to the UK to go to university. After working as a journalist, she then retrained as a chef at Leith's, and you'll hear why and how she did that. I spoke to Olya at the end of the summer about her first book called Mamushka that celebrates her family recipes from Ukraine and across Eastern Europe because she has family from all over. It's beautiful. It's a really useful tool, and it's a wonderful way to get started in that kind of cooking if you're totally new to it. We also talk about her brand new book Caucasus, which is out in the US now. It's a culinary journey through Georgia, Azerbaijan, and beyond in Central Asia. Honestly, it's one of the books I'm most excited about this year. It's so much more than a recipe book. It's a geographical, sociological study and love letter to this region of the world that some of it she knew already and some of it she came to discover when she was researching for the book. I can't recommend it highly enough for you, for anyone, for Christmas, for everybody. Just please, we'll listen to this and then go and buy it. Now let's hear what she had to say when I met her at the end of the summer. Hi, Olya. Welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb. So do you want to tell the listeners who you are?
Hi, I'm Olya Hercules. I was born in Ukraine and now I'm a chef and a food writer in London. And it's all kind of crazy still, but I'm here.
You, as you said, are not originally from the UK, but from Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Where did you grow up and how did food feature in your life growing up?
I'm from the south of Ukraine. As you know, Ukraine is a really huge country, bigger than France. So I come from a real melting pot. So it's Ukraine, but actually I've got influences from Central Asia, from Caucasus, from Tatars, from all over the place. That's what gives me my energy and my thirst for discovering more stuff all over Eastern Europe and beyond.
Do you want to describe what it was like growing up in Ukraine and what that looked like? Because I know you had a very rich childhood.
Yeah, so basically from April to October, it was very hot. And, you know, you'd be walking down the street and then some apricots and cherries, mulberries would be falling on your head just in the street. That's how it was. You'd come back as a child, you'd come back home and your feet would be stained black because you've just been walking on mulberries all day. And nobody thinks of that. Everybody thinks of Eastern Europe as, you know, this cold kind of Russia situation where nothing grows and it's all kind of really sad. But actually, Ukraine is so different. But I haven't appreciated it until I came here. And even after I became a chef, I still didn't make this connection with, you know, I tried to cook Ukrainian food here in the UK and it never worked. But that's because I always went to a supermarket. I was a poor student. So I went and bought a shitty chicken and some shitty onions. And I tried to make my Ukrainian food and it was shit. A while later, I realized, okay, I only need 5 ingredients, but I really need 5 amazing ingredients. Just like at home. Like, okay, the chickens look like dinosaurs and they look like, you know, running around and really skinny, but they were flavorsome and they were alive and they were real. So it's all about produce, it's all about heritage and about valuing what you have. But it's funny that I haven't made that connection until I realized how important produce was. Actually.
So why did you move to the UK?
Well, I actually left Ukraine when I was 12 with my parents because I was asthmatic. And they moved me to Cyprus because I felt better there. So actually, I spent 5 years in Cyprus before I went to the UK. And I went to an English school and I did my O-levels and I excelled at them. Then it was a choice between Columbia University in New York and England, and I chose England because it was closer to my family. So I studied Italian language and international studies. That gave me an opportunity to go to Italy for a year because we had the whole exchange thing. And it was actually, bizarrely, it was Italy. When I went to Italy and I actually spent 3 months in Palermo in Sicily, I went into this fish market and I sat at the table and I had a meal on my own. And then the restaurant owners like basically adopted me as their daughter, and I was their waitress and for the next 3 weeks. And then at some point, the guy that was cooking there, the owner, brought me a dish which was basically just pasta with some weird stuff on top. And I was like, "Oh, what's this weird stuff on top?" And I tried the pasta, and it blew my mind. My mind just exploded, and I was like, "What is this?" And he said, "Oh, it's spaghetti a ricci." And I was like, "Oh, make cazzo a ricci. What the fuck is ricci?" And he was like, "Huh, this is just sea urchin." And he basically just cracked open a raw sea urchin over hot pasta, which like cooked it by the residual heat. And that's when my epiphany came. And I just went, "Oh my freaking God, there's 3 ingredients here, maybe 4. Salt, spaghetti, urchin, olive oil. That's it. And water. If you want 5 ingredients, whatever." And I just realized that made me connect with Ukraine because it's not about the amount of ingredients that you use in a dish. It's about those 5 amazing ingredients that make a dish stand out. And so yesterday we did a talk at Borough Market. I spoke about my connection to markets in the UK and how they made me realize that actually the way that I can cook my food here is to connect to the produce and to the people that make it, because that's all that it's all about, you know? And I said yesterday, I was like, you can't, you know, so many people are like, "Oh, this meat is expensive. This organic meat is expensive. This is expensive. This is expensive." Dude, don't eat meat every day. It's okay. You can eat it once a week, but buy good quality stuff. It's not necessary, and actually it's not natural. My grandparents reared meat and they only had it as a treat. People are realizing that that's what makes food taste good, is the energy that's passed from the growers, the people that put so much effort into it. And
so was there, you went to Italy and you came back and that kind of re-sparked your love of food
made me realize that the five ingredients was okay. I didn't have to make anything up, but also that I could go to a farmer's market in the UK and find those ingredients. And if I couldn't find the exact ingredient, I could substitute it for something else. And actually, that's what my grandma did. So the whole snobbery about fusion and, you shouldn't fuse things, like every cuisine is fusion. Anywhere you go, it's just natural that things merge together, and it's a natural thing. You know, sometimes you write a recipe and people are like, with my second cookbook, for example, with Caucasus, there's, for example, some, dried plum paste or something. But I made sure that I give an alternative and I say, okay, if you can't find the dry plum paste, just use pomegranate molasses or verjuice or vinegar or lemon juice. It doesn't matter. The recipe is still going to be good, as long as you've got the best ingredient. That's what I say.
Mm. And so did you know what to cook? You know, had you been taught to cook in Ukraine? So when you were here and decided you want to cook again, did you know what?
No, I haven't. I wasn't one of those people that was by my mom's side. And even though she is my mom and my grandma and everyone is just like the most amazing cook. Like she can throw like dough in the air and do all of these like incredible things. But no, I wasn't. It was basically being here at university and missing my family. That's what made me reconnect with food. And that's what made me go, okay, I have to make something to like remind me of home. Otherwise, I'm just like way too homesick and way too like I was hurting, really.
What was the first thing you cooked?
That's what I was talking about at Borough Market yesterday. So basically, there's the Central Asian dish, which is basically a chicken, onions cooked in chicken fat, pasta, and it's layered. But the only shop that we had at Warwick was at Tesco. So basically, one of my grandmas was actually Siberian. And she left Siberia when she was in the 50s because it was a horrible place to be. So she picked up her daughter that was 8 and got on the train and went to the city of bread, which was Tashkent in Uzbekistan. On the way there, she met my grandfather, my Ukrainian grandfather. They eventually had my dad in Uzbekistan. But anyway, at that point, she met him on the train. He came up to her thing and he was just like, hello, would you like to play king with us? And he used the English word like for this obscure game. And she was like, oh, okay. And he was like, the condition is that you give me your address. She was so naive. She totally went for that pick-up line. She gave him her address. They played blah, blah, blah. She went to Uzbekistan, set up her life, and then within the 6 months she got a letter from him, like, with the most beautiful words, and like, la la la, I want to marry you. Eventually they didn't marry. Anyway, my dad was born in Tashkent, and she brought loads of dishes from that area to Ukraine. Eventually they moved to Ukraine, and one of the dishes was beshbarmak, which means with five fingers. So basically, it's a layered pasta, onions, and lamb originally, but she couldn't find lamb in Ukraine. She could just find really good fat chickens. So that's how she made it. So I know her Ukrainian version of beshbarmak. So that was it. That was my memory. And it's five ingredients, but the way that they were prepared are genius. So basically, you get a fat chicken, you put in some water with like minimum aromatics, bay leaf, whatever. You poach it until it's tender. You take it out. During the process, you skim the fat off and you reserve it. Then you slice loads of onions and you cook the fat in the reserved chicken fat until they're super tender and caramelized. Then the bouillon that you've got from cooking the chicken, you cook the pasta in. So you make like lasagna sheets and you make them into a rhombus shape and then you cook them in the chicken stock. And then basically you layer it. You've got the chickeny pasta, chicken, and the onions that are cooked in chicken fat. so exciting, and everything that's used is used to the max, you know? So that was my memory. And that's what I wanted to recreate when I became really, really homesick in at work.
You didn't train to be a chef at work, though, so you went...
I retrained. So I was a journalist after that. I was working for Screen International, quite a well-known film industry magazine for about 2 or 3 years as a junior reporter. And then in 2008, there was a massive financial crisis, basically. And I survived 5 rounds of redundancies. I saw people, like, running out of offices crying, and I was like, I can't believe I'm still here, oh my god. And then at the end I was just like doing a job of 3 people, and then at some point I got really ill, and it was during the whole like swine flu situation. I wasn't sure if I had that or not, but I was really ill. I think I was just really overworked, and I remember sitting there and on the couch, like wrapped in all these blankets, and then this thing came on TV, and it was like, it was like Lee's School of Food and Wine. And I turned to my ex-husband then and was like, why am I not doing that? And he was like, I really don't know, because you're obsessed with food. I don't know why you're not doing that. And then I went back to the office, and I went back to my senior editor, and I told him, you know what, I'm thinking, am I next in the redundancy line? And he was like, yeah. I was like, oh, thank you for your honesty. Do you think I should go and retrain to be a chef? And he said, yes. Oh. And I was like, thank you. Okay.
Bye.
Yeah. But once my editor said that, I was like, okay, I'm quitting. Before you make me redundant, I'm going to quit.
Well, that's great. You left on a high.
And I went to my mom and we Skyped. And I was like, Mom, I've got something important to tell you. And she was like, no, stop. I've got something to tell you. I was like, okay. And she was like, I had a dream. I was like, okay. And she was like, I had a dream. Me and you were on the bus and we were riding somewhere. And then you told me, stop, I'm going to get off. And I was, and she said, she was so freaked out. And I got off the bus and she saw me like move away somewhere. But then she saw me like moving up the hill somewhere. And she had like a feeling of that it was fine. And she let me go and she was like, it's fine. And she told me this dream, and I was like, okay. So my news are, I know that you paid so much money for my master's degree and my other degree and my school and blah, blah, blah. I'm thinking of going to the bank to ask for some money because I want to be a chef now. And she was like, we're going to help you. We can help you. And they helped me.
Wow. That's beautiful. What a crazy coincidence. My goodness. That's stunning. So where did you train?
Leith's School of Food and Wine.
And how was the experience?
It was amazing. It was amazing. It was incredible. They gave me so much confidence in terms of my, theory. And, I mean, we did practice and everything. But it wasn't until I went and worked for Otolenghi that I went, okay, everything I learned, I'm going to learn again. Because that was a different kind of school. That was school for stamina. Yeah, it was tough.
But not many people train and go straight to work for someone like a group.
The Big O.
The Big O, exactly.
That's what he's called in the UK, by the way.
Is he? Yeah. Oh, I didn't know that. That's wonderful. So, but not many chefs go from culinary school to that. So how did that happen? How did you get into
it? I mean, I was working in Fulham in the brasserie. I was like one of the chef de parties, part-time head chef. And then my head chef, because he knew that I kind of based my whole career and leaving my... Otolenghi was a massive, massive influence on me.
Why is that?
I read... I was a big follower of his column. But also, I read his story and I knew that he was an academic. And then he did all of this university stuff. And then he gave it up and he came to London and he did all of this like crazy restaurant shit. And he succeeded. And I thought, if he can do it, I can do it. So then when I was working for these people at Fulham, my head chef said, Olya, I know how like strongly you feel about this. Basically, Otolenghi is like looking for people. I think you should apply. And I was like, wow, that's so cool. Thanks, dude. And I applied. And they were initially looking for people at Nopi, but they said, actually, at least LinkedIn, we need some more chefs, and they took me in.
What was your role? What did you have to do?
I was chef de partie, so I was also a breakfast chef. It was an interesting time. It was a tough time. I thought it was going to come in and everybody's going to be talking about Barbaries and unicorns, but it wasn't.
It's an intense place.
It was intense, yeah. Of course it was.
Yeah.
Like any other kitchen, you know?
But do you think, are you pleased you did it?
Mm-hmm, yeah. When I gave birth, I say, you know what, if you've done like professional kitchen, you brought your stamina up to a certain point, birth is okay. I am not kidding. Like, it's okay. Like, it was, I felt, it gave me strength, for sure. Mm. Like, if you can stand on your feet for 18 days and take a certain amount of shit, like, it's fine. When you give birth, you can't complain. You just feel like, oh, it's a bit rude to complain. Like,
so after you finished your time with Otelengi, was that...
I had Sasha.
You had Sasha. Okay, your son. Then what happened? Did the book come out of that time? Or
No. I worked... So when I was 8 months pregnant, I was working in a... I was doing, like, Sunday lunches in a restaurant with my big stomach. So I had to navigate around the big kitchen.
As a chef?
Yeah.
Wow.
I was working until 2 weeks before I gave birth. But I didn't want to lie down. Like, I was always active. I was just like... I was lucky. I didn't have any... sickness, whatever. I was just like, the only thing that's stopping me is my stomach, but actually I could not lie down. I had to like be moving all the time, and it was an amazing time. And he saved me. Like, my son gave me such a massive drive, like, straight away. Then I gave birth, and for 6 months it was just enveloped in this thing. And then once the first 6 months passed, the woman that I used to work for with the big stomach in the kitchen got a TV show with Food Network, Red Hot and Yummy, I think it was called. And she asked me to come and do a couple of shows with her. And it was for Madness in Cornwall. She asked me to do her food stall at Truman Brewery, and I said yes. But then somebody else offered me a recipe development thing for a startup. And that was much more suitable for me and the one-year-old boy. So that's what I did for a year. I developed about... during the whole time, I developed about 400 recipes for them in 8 months, testing, shooting, whatever. And then the company folded.
No.
And then in February, I was breaking up with Sasha's dad. I lost my job. So I was really freaking depressed. Bizarrely, I started writing for Guardian Cook. Guardian Cook, Mina Holland, is just like the most fucking amazing woman. I kind of entered her thing through get-togethers. They had this column. I said, me and my partner, it's my birthday. I'm turning 29. I'm having a global barbecue. I'm cooking Georgian recipes and Northern Thai recipes for my partner. And they featured me, and then they wanted me to stay on. So I actually had quite a few recipes in the Guardian Cook. So when I was in this situation, when nothing was happening, my agent spotted my Ukrainian recipes and cook. And she wrote to me and she was like, I'm from United Nations. There is possibility of a cookbook. Could you come and see me? And I was like, oh. And, you know, this whole thing, like, war happening, like, starting in Ukraine, my parents are, like, you know, freaking out, whatever. And I went and I saw her, and I talked to her for 2 hours, and told her everything about me, and she said, you take every single point, but go and work on your profile for another 2 years, and we'll talk then. My heart sank. I went, but I had something there already. So I started doing test shoots. I asked lots of photographers to shoot Ukrainian food. And then there was this woman that, bizarrely, like, I never check LinkedIn, but she sent me a message through LinkedIn, and she said, I used to do video, but I want to do stills now. Would you do a test shoot with me? And I said, yeah, well, if you film me in return. Like, let's do a barter. That's a nice thing. And she was like, okay. And then my friend organized a flat that actually overlooked the Guardian offices. It was so weird. So she filled me and I made Georgian like chicken tabaka, which eventually was one of the recipes in the book. And then she sent the film to Guardian offices who didn't know about any of my recipes. She sent it to the Guardian video guys and she said, this is what I'm doing now. Give me a job. And then the producer went, who is this woman? Like, can you ask her to come in? And we went in and I talked to him and then he called Faber Guardian, the publisher, and he was like, you've got a book deal over here. Like, nobody's doing the Eastern European thing. And they came in with an offer straight away. And then I called Ariella, who is still my agent now. She was the original one. And I said, okay, you said 2 years. It's been 2 months. It's happening now.
Wow.
So February was the horrible, destitute, kind of horrendous time. By April, I had three publishers fighting for the cookbook. And I'm still pinching myself.
Let's take a quick break and hear from our sponsors. Le Cordon Bleu, the renowned culinary school, was founded in Paris 122 years ago by a young journalist named Mademoiselle d'Estelle. In 1895, she launched the first weekly culinary magazine called La Cuisinière Le Cordon Bleu. She invited subscribers to take part in free cooking lessons with the chefs featured in her magazine. And from there, the school was born. In the years since, the Cordon Bleu's world-class instructors have taught French classical culinary techniques to everyone from home enthusiasts to food world legends. If you've dreamt of attending culinary school, maybe it's time to quit that boring corporate job and check out one of Le Cordon Bleu's 35 locations around the world. Or add a short workshop or weekend program at one of its schools to your next vacation. Visit cordonbleu.edu for course descriptions, dates, and online registration. It's all possible at Le Cordon Bleu. Welcome back to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Let's go back a tiny bit. So you began to write the book called Mamushka, which was your first book.
So Ariella then was like, okay, you have to, you know that it's not such an easy thing. You basically have to write a dissertation. You have to, the proposal is about 20 pages. You have to give 100 recipes names and about 12 recipes written out. She told me, you've got like a night. So I put Sasha to bed at 8 o'clock in the evening. I sat down at about 9:30 and I finished at 4 o'clock in the morning, but I wrote it. I wrote everything and I gave it to her and that's what got me my book deal, basically.
Wow. So how did you have the recipes to at that point?
Well, it was Mamushka. It was me. It was my family. Like, I knew what I was doing. Just, it was the stuff that I grew up with. I just had to delve into the memory. Like, it was... That's why, like, the first book was actually quite easy.
Because it just came out.
It just came out. I wrote it in 4 months. Wow. I wrote the whole thing and tested and everything. It was done in 4 months.
That was obviously meant to be then.
It's actually a little bit mad.
It is.
If you think about it.
Do you want to just explain the book briefly?
In the 80s, we started getting VHS. Like, the first ever video that we got, me and my dad used to go to this dodgy guy in the flat. And he used to give us like some tapes, some really, really dodgy tapes because it wasn't allowed. Like, it was still Soviet Union at that point. And every tape that we got that had any reference to Soviet Union or Ukraine or whatever, it was Arnie doing his whole like, if you die, you die thing. You know what I mean? Like, it was always really negative. And then finally, we got the Addams Family. And at some point, they break into this dance and they say, ah, we got the Mamushka dance. And they dance this thing and it sounds gypsy, kind of Ukrainian, whatever. And they dance to it and they shout Mamushka. And me and my brother just thought it was hilarious, frankly. And we started calling my mom Mamushka. Like, she's saved as that on my phone. And then when the whole book deal came about and the whole name thing, I just mentioned it just very casually in an email to someone, and they were like, oh, this is the name. What does mamushka mean? And I explained this whole story, and they were like, oh, yes.
Because it's, people might think it's a Ukrainian word.
But it's not. It's not.
No. But it, but does it have any similarities to the word mother or not?
I mean, babushka is grandma.
Okay.
So mamachka is mommy.
So it's like a wonderful blend of the all three.
Yeah. It's kind of a made up thing, but it's also very sweet.
Yeah.
You know? Who cares? Like it's a story.
Yeah. Summarize the book. It fell out of you because you had so much to give it, but it was my starting book on Eastern European food. But do you want to just summarize what people can expect inside that book?
Just every recipe that I encountered from the age of, since I was born until whatever. Basically, I went to Ukraine. I sat down with my mom and my auntie, and we drew up a list of 100 recipes.
100?
Yeah.
Just between you?
Yeah.
Wow.
Just 100 recipes, like 100 essential recipes that we've always cooked.
I mean, some people repeat dinners multiple times in a week, but 100 recipes, that's... And are they split up into...
Yeah, so from broths to meat to fish, vegetables, desserts, whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So for someone who doesn't know, well, who might have a sort of beige image of what Eastern European food is...
It's so sad. It's so sad.
I know.
When the whole thing happened with the thing, like I met, I think it was the editor of the Sunday Times or something. And he said, oh yes, I went to the Soviet Union in the 70s. I went to the Czech Republic and I went to this restaurant and the food was just like grey gruel. And it's like, of course it was. Of course it was. Like the Soviet Union just suppressed everything. Like, had you been at the same time at my grandma's house and she cooked something for you, which is all that mamushka is about, you would have had the most incredible food. And we were so lucky. And you know, there's an amazing writer called Anya von Bremzen from New York. I mean, she's originally from Moscow. I love her books, Please to the Table and The Art of Soviet Cooking. She's absolutely incredible, but her experiences in Moscow during the Soviet Union are so different from ours. Even though we were repressed and everything, we had the climate and we had the soil and we had the opportunity to grow the most incredible produce. And that's what I grew up with. And that's what the difference is. And it's still the same. Mm. I've lived in Italy. I've never tasted tomatoes as good as in Ukraine.
Wow. So explain maybe what's a meal, a sort of basic, a standard meal you might have in Ukraine or that might also feature in the book as well.
Okay, so in the summer, my mom would pick cucumbers, tomatoes and radishes and spring onions and dill from her garden and she'd chop them into the bowl, just over the bowl like that. And once she chops the cucumbers, you get the whiff of them and you're like, they're not the massive, horrendous dill ones. They're like the tiny little prickly, and like almost dry. You always think of cucumbers as really wet and watery, but they're not. When you cut the, you know, circumference of a Ukrainian cucumber, it's so concentrated in flavor. There's not much water in it. That's why they're such good pickles as well. So it's almost like a pickling cucumber. So she chop all of that into the bowl and the tomatoes are so ripe. And then you drop like a spoonful of a sour cream, some salt and some dill, and you mix it all together. And the tomatoes are so ripe that they, you know, the release of all of the juice into the sour cream. So once you finish that salad at the end, you've got this pool of like pink, radishy, tomatoey, sour cream, dill liquid. And that's what we fought for. You know, you get a little bit of bread and you're just like, I want to get a little bit of this. And that's one of the most amazing things that I've ever had. So simple. They would like throw this like phyllo dough around their head and whatever. They've done amazing things. but it's actually some very simple things like yogurt, radishes, tomatoes, cucumber, dill, spring onion, boom.
Which literally anyone can make.
Yes.
Yeah. And is there anything, do you have a favourite in the book that might be a good introduction to something that people don't know is Eastern European, or?
This salad.
Salad, yeah.
As well as borscht. I know it's...
What's borscht?
What's borscht? Borscht is a different thing in every country in Eastern Europe. Even within each country, in Ukraine, the borscht from the north is very different from the borscht from the south. So our borscht in the south is not red because of beetroot. In fact, we use something like Georgia beetroot. We use a pink beetroot, which doesn't give any color. Our borscht is red because of the tomatoes. We put so much tomato in our borscht. That's what I say, like, everybody just puts Eastern European cuisine into one basket, and that's so wrong. Because even if you go into Poland, Ukraine, any other country, the cuisine from Ukraine, from the north, is so different from the south, you know? Mm. We grow amazing watermelons, tomatoes, aubergines. In the west, they've got seps the size of my forearm, you know?
And people don't have that image.
And no, they don't. They think of Italy in that way, but they don't think of Ukraine in that way. Mm-hmm. Everything just gets bunged up into one thing. Mm-hmm. So that's the difference. That's what I want to dispel.
Absolutely. So Mamushka was a huge success, and you obviously realised you could do it, and it wasn't that hard. Mm. But what happened between then and you now have another book coming out called Caucasus? So what was the process between? I mean, things must have suddenly gone crazy for you after that came out.
Yes, it has. And actually, the second cookbook was a big source of anxiety for me, because the first book just came out of, and the second cookbook, I went there and I researched and I met people and I got their recipes and I got pictures of them and their food. And now I have to deliver almost, and I feel like if I don't justify it, it's horrendous. It's actually really quite unnerving. I mean, there is a personal connection. Like, one of my aunts is half Armenian, half Ukrainian, and that's why I did it. Like, her stories of Nagorno-Karabakh and Azerbaijan and stuff, like, she really inspired me. But it's not something comes from first person, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I feel that I have to do them good.
Of course. But you definitely have. I've seen the book. It's absolutely beautiful. But explain what it is. So it's called Caucasus.
So it's called Caucasus, and it's all about Georgia, Armenia, Azerbaijan. I've been all around Georgia. I've been some amazing places in Azerbaijan. Unfortunately, I didn't have enough budget to go to Armenia. But because my auntie is Armenian, I've included Armenian recipes in it.
I want to ask you briefly about your attitude with food, with your son. So having a child, did that change anything about food and what?
No.
No, but also what have you... I'm sure he's very interested in it, given who you are.
So one of his grandmas is Ukrainian and the other one is Thai, like Lao. So he has no choice. He's got chicken gizzards on one side and lemongrass and crazy chili on the other. So actually, like, he says, "Mama, I don't like fish. I just like fish eyes."
Wow. And he's how old?
5.
But, and is it important to you? Has it been important to you to teach him about food? And
Yeah, but I'm also very relaxed about it. It's not like a thing. And also if he says, like, "Oh, Mama, I don't want to eat this," I'm like, "Well, that's what you got. I'm sorry, but that's how it was for me, and that's how it's going to be for you. I'm not going to make a children menu for you. If you don't want to eat tonight, fine." And it does happen. Even though he likes fish eyes, and he's crazy, and he loves squid, like, squid is his favorite thing. He's just like, if there's something else that he says, "Oh, Mama, I don't want to eat that," I'm like, tough shit. Like, this is what I'm giving you.
And he must be learning a lot as well.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But I'm saying to all the parents, like, don't do purees. Like, once they turned 6, what I did was to give him a lamb chop, and he would suck on it. He had no teeth, but he would taste the texture and the flavor and whatever I didn't like blend broccoli and salmon together.
And he's interested.
And he's interested. And he does have moments when he's like, oh, I don't want to eat that. But overall, he's like, I'm going to eat fish eyes. You know what I mean?
And there aren't many five-year-olds in this country
who... Or squid or octopus or whatever. But I have pictures of him spitting it out when he's 6 months old. So do not create a situation where it's a special thing. And then your kids are going to be all right and they're going to eat the stuff that you eat.
Mm. If you're, and especially if you're excited about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, for sure. Mm. And that's why, Sasha's dad is amazing in that.
That's great. Okay, yeah. So last thing, Cherry Bomb is this wonderful community of women, and we're celebrating women across food, and women seem to have been a big part of your food world.
I
wanted to know if that you think that's the case, and also how you feel like you've been received as a woman, and whether that's either helped or hindered you in what you've done.
Well, so basically my second cookbook, it's called Caucasus now, and that was a compromise, but actually I wanted to call it Dedekatsi, which is a thing that I learned in Georgia, and it means mother man. There's a really amazing thing that happened after the Second World War. All of these Georgian men came back from the war, and I recognize that because the same thing happened in Ukraine. Like, I remember my granddad being really traumatized, and fuck, there was no support for that, right? Like, in Eastern Europe, nobody supported those men that came back from the war. So they just gave up. And women took over because they were strong. And they had children. And they had to keep going. But there was a thing in Georgia that they called Deda Katsi. Deda means mother. Katsi means, like, katsu in Italian, but it means man. So mother man. And for me, it was the most incredible discovery. And I've met so many women like that who have nothing to do with the feminist movement, maybe. Like, they don't know what it is, but they are that.
Personified, yeah. That's fantastic. And that you, and that's had an influence on you?
It has, but there are so many times when I went to Georgia, and there were women cooking and farming and doing all this shit, and their sons are just standing in the corner and smoking, and you're like, your heart sinks. But then there was this one woman that had this her own personal bakery. She worked there the whole day, and her 7-year-old grandson was on hand the whole time. But it wasn't forced. She wasn't making him. He was just there for her. He was just doing everything for her. And then that picture where he just, like, she looks in the oven and checks the bread, and he just put his hand on the back of her, on the lower back. Dude, it was just...
That's beautiful.
So she is cultivating this new generation of men that see what these dedekatsi are doing, these mother men. Mm. How wonderful is this term, mother men? I really connected it to it, and so did my photographer, because she was a single mother at the time as well.
Wow. Well, that's what you're doing as well. So, Olia, thank you so much for being on Radio Cherry Bomb. I want you to tell everybody where they can find you. So
it's Olia Hercules on Instagram, and
the book. Do you know when the book is coming out in America?
It's coming out in October, I believe, but copies are apparently available in November. So,
how exciting! Thank you so much, Olia.
Thank you so much for having me. Bye.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you so much, as always, to our legendary engineer, Dave Tattershaw. Dave, I miss you. A big thank you to Le Cordon Bleu. Be sure to visit cordonbleu.edu for information about this legendary culinary school. You can also subscribe to Radio Cherry Bomb and leave a review for the show wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear your dream guest for the show. And what would my dream guest be? I would love to interview B. Wilson. B, if you're listening, hit me up. And be sure to pick up the newest issue of Cherry Bomb magazine. I'm so excited to get my hands on this. It's called Yes Chef. It's all about the coolest female chefs in the world, one of whom is slap bang on the cover, is one of our own British bomb squad, April Bloomfield, who is doing her best to represent the UK in America. I think she's doing a fine job. There's another very special British Bomb Squad member inside the magazine as well, called Maxine Thompson, who you'll be hearing from very soon on Radio Cherry Bomb. She is the founder of the world-renowned Poker Pants. So do check it out. Go and grab a copy wherever you are. It'll be there somewhere. It's worth the hunt. Anyway, thanks so much for having me today. It's been a pleasure to be back on Radio Cherry Bomb. And thanks for listening, everybody. You're the bomb.
I'm Atara.
And I'm Arielle, and we're the founders of Pineapple Collaborative, an inclusive community for women who love food. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb Magazine and the Heritage Radio Network. To subscribe or learn more about the magazine, visit cherrybomb.com.
You know who we think is the bomb? Alex L., a DC author and poet, because she teaches us that food is a vehicle for self-love and acceptance.
Radio Cherry Bomb is powered by Simplecast. Simplecast is a popular hosting and analytics platform that allows podcasters to easily host and publish to apps like Apple Podcasts. If you have a podcast or are looking to create your very first, check it out. Try it for free and save half off your first 3 months at simplecast.com/heritage.